Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
The Sweet Science. I grew up watching boxing with my old man. As an immigrant to this country, it was the sport he was an expert in. He didn't need to know how downs work or why pitchers hit in one league and not in the other. It was just, I'm going to beat your ass. At its purest, boxing can be. Two combatants enter, one leaves. It's the purest distillation of how much do you want it. And even then, sometimes it doesn't matter because the other guy is just better at beating people's asses. Some guys can just take a punch and some guys hit like a goddamn pickup truck. The sport has always been maligned by money, greed, and bad people. I think it's safe to say the sport is corrupted now, but there have always been golden eras. None more golden than when the heavyweight division matters. And let me tell you, the heavyweights mattered. From the late 80s to the late 90s, you all know Mike Tyson, Iron Mike, deeply flawed, impossibly talented. Well, Mike famously lost to Buster Douglas. Buster lost to Evander Holyfield, and Evander lost to a big old horse named Riddick Bowe. Bowe was 6 feet, 5 inches, and 270 plus pounds with long arms, longer jabs, big hooks, and a nasty ability to fight inside. Big, sweeping uppercuts. Looked like you might die if he caught you. However you wanted to fight, Bo could, as previously stated, beat your ass. Picture this. Riddick Bo is undefeated, 26-0, and facing fellow heavyweight Elijah Tillery in a 12-round bout. Bo dominates the first frame, knocks Tillery down with 8 seconds left in the round. Elijah gets back up off the canvas, but as the round ends and the bell rings, the two cross paths on their way back to their corners. Riddick Bowe, out of nowhere, throws a jab at Tillery's forehead. Tillery kicks Bowe. Bowe throws a right cross. Tillery kicks him again. And then Riddick Bowe's manager jumps up ringside, grabs Tillery from behind, around his neck, and flips Tillery 360 degrees over the top rope and out of the ring. Somehow, Tillery is disqualified. Team Bowe creates a fracas in the ring, and Riddick Bowe is awarded his 27th straight victory. A few fights later, Bowe beat the aforementioned Evander Holyfield for the WBC, WBA, and IBF heavyweight championship belts. But during their rematch, as Holyfield and Bowe faced off again in the 7th round, a man jumped out of an airplane, opened his parachute, and used a giant propeller fan on his back to direct himself and float down into the ring where they're fighting. And what happens to that man? Riddick Bowe's team, Team Bowe, immediately grabs him, drags him into the audience, and beats the living shit out of him. This is all true. The fan man, Google it. Future First Ballot episode for sure. Bowe lost his belts to Evander that night, but in the years that followed, Bowe slowly tried to put his career back together, eventually taking a fight with a Polish heavyweight named Andrew Galata. Well, what happened in Andrew Galata's career? Let me tell you. Imagine this. Andrew Galata is a perfect 23-0, and he's facing heavyweight Samson Paua in Atlantic City, New Jersey. In the 4th round, Galata's in deep, deep trouble. Paua has Galata stumbling all over the ring. So the crafty Pole holds on to Paua and bites his friggin' neck. He bites him hard. There are like giant red teeth marks on Paua's neck. But strangely, and because it's boxing, the bout continues. And Galata knocks Paua out in the next round. But that's not all. In addition to a long reputation of low blows, on March 15th, 1996, undefeated Andrew Galata faced Donnell Nicholson again in Atlantic City, New Jersey. Galata dominant through the start of the fight, but as the fight pushes on into the fifth round, Galata grabbed Nicholson, held him close, reared back, and headbutted Nicholson right on the temple. Donnell Nicholson immediately walks to his corner and collapses. But because it's boxing, the fight continued. Nicholson gets worked for three more rounds, and eventually, finally, his corner throws in the towel. 4 months later, an undefeated Andrew Galata agrees to face the 39-1 former heavyweight champion Riddick Bowe in Madison Square Garden. Whatever would happen here? Galata opens up the fight strong, but Riddick Bowe would not fold. He returns fire. As is his history, Galata gets frustrated, throws a low blow in the second, another low blow in the third. Galata throws a nasty low blow in the fourth and loses a point. Galata refuses to stop. Another low blow in the sixth, another in the seventh results in a second point deduction. And before the seventh round is over, Galata throws one last ripping, nasty low blow that ends the fight. Galata is disqualified. Bowe is declared the winner, but he is a pile on the floor. So what does Team Bowe do? The Team Bowe that flipped a man out of the ring and beat a fan man senseless in the crowd? Well, Team Bowe turned the ring into another goddamn fracas. The word melee isn't used a lot, and that's because the word melee isn't often appropriate. But on this night, melee is right on the nose. Fights spray across the garden, inside the ring, outside the ring, into the audience, outside of the garden. That was one night of boxing, and this is First Ballot. Welcome to First Ballot, the podcast that celebrates the moments in sports that really matter and inducts them into the First Ballot Hall of Fame. I am your host, Neil, the podcast Jordan Clarkson, coming to you live from the Shaquille O'Neal Office Depot, big and tall executive suite desk chair in my basement. Today's episode of the First Ballot Hall of Fame podcast could be sponsored by Jollibee. I've never been to Jollibee, ever. I'm half Filipino. My father grew up there. He emigrated to the States. Jollibee now all over the country. It's particularly in where I live here on the East Coast. It's close. I could go to Jollibee, but I've never been there. And also, for the record, it's not a health thing. I was raised on fast food. I've just never been to Jollibee. Does that make me a bad Filipino-American? Perhaps. Would going to Jollibee and taste testing everything make for compelling branded content that could be sponsorable during a podcast where I discuss boxing with a famously near Filipino white American? I think so, Jollibee. Hit up your boy. Give me some money. A guy's got to eat. The Riddick Bowe Andrew Galata fight, the first one between them in 1996, was a great sports moment. But is it a First Ballot Hall of Famer? We have to decide that today. And here to do it with me is a very special guest. He's a friend of mine. He's a great writer. He's a great editor. He's a great host. I will forever think of him as the writer of the immortal Pacific Rim's book about the Filipino love for the sport of basketball. You have to read it if you haven't. He's also the author of Two and Two, a book about his father. And he's the writer of the new podcast, Hoops Paradise, hosted by Cassidy Hubbard and Slam's Nico Ramos. It's Mr. Rafe Bartholomew.
All right, Neil, what's going on? It's good to see you again, man.
Likewise,
remember seeing
sir.
You in the ESPN office with Jacoby.
I know. It was so lovely to see you. I've always been very jealous of you, which you don't know this. I'm a very competitive person, and I keep that just below my skin level. I try not to tell people how jealous I am of them or how much I want to defeat them or take their careers. I've always been jealous of you because I think you're very good at your job, but also, and much more importantly, you are probably more Filipino than I am, and that really gets under my skin. What are your thoughts on that?
Jollibee should not be the ultimate decider in that decision. Nor look, I mean, the truth is, you Filipino is not something you earn with how much you eat Jollibee, what languages you know or don't. You are, you aren't, you are, and I'm not.
No, but you're close. I mean, it's you really, as a white guy, and you're not just a white guy, you're also a tall white guy. So you're like a big white dude. You are as Filipino as a giant white guy could possibly get. And again, here, to me, the size makes it impressive because as a bigger white guy, you're even further away from being a smaller Filipino man. Like, you couldn't get, I mean, the bigger you are to me as a white guy, the further you are from being Filipino. But still with that, you are dangerously close to being Filipino. We appreciate you.
At least I was at the opening of the very first East Coast Jollibee in, you know, in Woodside, Queens, back in 2009, Valentine's Day.
Is that true?
Absolutely. I waited 4 hours for a chicken joy, and I got there at 9 a.m.
Do you sincerely like Jollibee?
I do. It's nostalgic from the time that I lived in the country. I don't know if I would, if you forced me to rank it against other foods I love, it wouldn't necessarily be there. But the taste of that spaghetti, it does something to me.
I bet. What? Tell me about, so I don't know. I don't know how you, tell me about how your connection to the Philippines. When did you first go? Like, where does it come from?
In a lot of ways, it's just dumb luck. I was coming out of college right around the time that a writer from Sports Illustrated, Alex Wolf, did a book where he traveled around the world and did a chapter on basketball in each place. The chapter on the Philippines just blew my mind. And I wound up getting a research grant out of college to go live there and stayed there longer than I was supposed to. Ended up working on Pacific Rim, spent time with pro teams there and went all around the country. And it really was like this basketball dreamland for me.
That's amazing. Tell me about about watching a PBA game there. How is it different from seeing an NBA game?
Oh, man. I mean, so on the good side of it, you have if you go to the popular team, which is Barangay Ginebra, their game is an incredible atmosphere. They drew almost 55,000 to a game last month when I was in the country visiting for the first time for a few years. And there it will feel like the entire arena, regardless of like everyone is just cheering for that team. And they have I didn't witness this was before my time, but back in the day they said, you know, when things would start going wrong, fans would start throwing piece of coins onto the players, and it still feels wild like that even without the dangerous projectiles hitting the floor. Sometimes though, you could go to a game, especially because the PBA has games 4 days a week, two games at doubleheaders every time. And the early doubleheader will start at like 3 p.m. when people are still at work. And it can be a drag. I mean, I covered those games. The people, as much love as there is for basketball in the country, sometimes people just can't show up to a game and there won't be the crowd you're looking for.
I love the team names there. Do you have a favorite professional Filipino basketball team name?
Ever, I would probably go with the Pure Foods Corned Beef Cowboys. And Pure Food. So, I mean, the story behind all this is that, you know, since the very beginning of the PBA, teams were named after the products that the team owners owned.
Right.
It's a marketing vehicle. That's the business excuse for this league is to market products. So especially that Pure Foods franchise, almost every 2 years would run in their new thing, their new, whatever their new meat product was. they were the jumbo hot dogs. They were the corned beef cowboys, the carne norte cowboys. I mean, you name it. I think they were the chunky giants when I first got to the country.
Can I admit to you something? This is a deep shame of mine. I've never been to the Philippines.
A lot of people who are born here and are Filipino haven't been back yet or ever.
It's really depressing. And by the by, I'm sure any Filipino that's listening to this is like, fuck yeah, they do. Every Filipino person I ever meet, if I tell them I'm Filipino, because I'm 6'3", so I'm sort of, again, on the tall side. And it's, I think Filipinos love it when they meet me and I tell them I'm Filipino because I also don't look like I'm Filipino. And then they go, have you ever been? And I go, no. And they go, you haven't? And I go, I know. And then I get the same lecture and the same speech. I've never been. If I, how many times have you been to the Philippines? Do you even know?
I mean, it will be hard to count. I've lived there. Have you added up the time that I've spent there since 2005 when I first went? Mm. It would probably be about 6 years, those, whatever, 15 plus years.
Let's say I rob a bank. That's what would have to happen. I go rob a bank, which I fully believe I could do. 100% believe I could pull that off. I rob a bank. I've got the money. I've got money to burn. I decide I'm going to go to the Philippines. I've always wanted to go. I've never been. Where do I go? What is the itinerary you give me? What are the things I have to do in the Philippines?
Okay, so you, even though it is touristy, you do have to go to Boracay. It is, they call it the greatest beach in the world a lot of the time. I haven't been to every beach in the world, but I wouldn't I wouldn't be surprised if it actually lives up to that. Awesome. I got to play in a basketball tournament there. I had a free trip for a week. I was the import. It was one of the greatest, like, the highlights of my life. I would go there for sure. Then some of, like, if you, I don't know if you're, how much you get out and hike and do stuff like that these days, but the rice terraces in northern Luzon are really, really stunning. Look, you, the other great thing about it, you cannot go wrong pretty much just walking into any town hall in the country saying, show me what cool stuff you have.
Yeah.
And it'll be something that isn't listed anywhere, but all of a sudden you're underneath a waterfall and, you know, feeling like something truly magical is about to happen. It's a beautiful country in that way.
This is, like, depressing to me. It's like, it's lovely to hear you talk about it. And I really appreciate you doing it as a white guy. I don't mean to dismiss you as a white guy, but as a non-Filipino person, I appreciate your love of the country. But it's also deeply depressing to me because I've never been, and I don't know when the hell I'm going to get there. I have no money. I need fucking Jollibee to throw me some scratch for that great promo I just did. And I'll get over there. I'm going to do it. At some point, I'm going to do it. Okay, Rafe, before we dive into our moment, we have to table set. What is your favorite sport, your favorite team, if you have one, and your favorite athlete of all time?
I'm all over the place, man. Look, my favorite sport is still basketball. I know about to talk about boxing, but that's the sport I grew up playing, the sport that I still try to play on some level, even though I just hurt myself every other week, like the one time I go out. it's still the one that I'm actually closest to. As a spectator, I did grow this love for boxing that kind of started in the Philippines because it was when I was living there, it was the height of Manny Pacquiao becoming the one of the biggest fighters in the world, or eventually the biggest for a time. And that just meant the entire sport was on TV there all the time for free. So I got to see Manny fights and every other fight for like 4 years straight. Favorite team, the only team I ever had that emotional connection with is the New York Mets. I was born in 1982. You know, 86 and 88, you know, Daryl, Doc, Ray Knight, Mookie Wilson, all of, like, that's, you know, Danny Ojeda, you know, and his finger. I mean, all of that, Bobby Ojeda. That's the one that I will still go back to. And then favorite athlete. I mean, just because it's the one, only, he's the only athlete I can say I grew up with, is Smush Parker. We played on the same team growing up together downtown, and you know, in a lot of ways, him being so good and making me feel like I was also good kept me playing basketball much longer than maybe I had any business to.
Oh my God. Oh, so we have so much to talk about here. Hold on. Wait a second. Let's stay on Smush for a moment. You played with Smush. You're on the same team.
Yes.
Before we dive into that, how deep did you play in your career? Did you play in college? Like, how far did you play basketball?
I played club ball in college. Basically, I went to D1 school, couldn't play there.
I get it. I like to act like I could have, but I 100% get it. So in high school, did you start?
Yes.
I love this. Okay. What NBA player comp, who did you play like?
NBA player comp.
Yeah. I mean, because listen, we got to know who this is.
Right,
person.
That's true.
Know.
Yeah. oh, man.
Who did you watch and like go, oh, I'm going to take a little bit of this and a little bit of that?
Chris
like,
Webber. I mean, I it was Chris Webber and Juwan Howard both, because I wanted to be right in the sweet spot there.
I was
right at the age where I thought I was going to grow to a comparable height rather than about the same height as you, 6'3". And so that's what I thought I was going to end up as. What we ended up with, who was that guy? That guy that was on, that white guy on the Mavericks, was it Brian Carpenter?
Oh, Cardinal.
Brian Cardinal. Yeah. That might have been, you know, or right. I mean, players who I hate, Adam Keefe. You know, especially, at higher, against good players, you know, I was smart. And I could guard well, and I didn't mind when I got embarrassed. Like, I just keep playing. Like, so I was valuable in those ways.
Great answers. Great answers all around. So what is Smush like as a teammate? When did you meet Smush? How old were you guys?
Oh, shoot. I mean, I can go way back. So we were about 9 years old, I think.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, and it was when, I guess, that was when he was just playing in the inter, you know, in our rec center league.
Yeah.
And I think a year or two after that, I got added to the traveling team. And people were like, you're going to get to play with Smush. You're going to be on Smush's team now. A friend of mine's mom grabbed me after school. And Smush went to a different school than me. But like this kid's mom grabbed me and was like, you know, he's a genius, right? He never misses. I know people are probably cracking up based on the NBA career that he had after all this. But it felt that way back then. Didn't miss from the first time I ever met him. And so playing with him, you felt confident as hell. And the rest of us were good too. But we would go into gyms and destroy people. We won like a Manhattan Borough Championship, winning, 80-10 a lot of the time.
Oh my
and
gosh.
Just, you know, like, and we had like, you know, we were a downtown team. So we had, I mean, we were still not, we only a couple white kids on the team, but that was more than most in the gyms we would go into. And, you know, we would feel like we were just amazing, you know. We would go in there and just blow some team out and take the you know, the green parks department van back to our gym and eat pizza.
What a great story. That idea of this NBA guy that, you know, maybe this person was a role player, or maybe they got traded a bunch of times, or maybe there's a, you know, internet jokes about him or whatever. But you're right, through high school, particularly through like childhood, through high school, through college, that person probably absolutely dominated everyone, because that's how giant the disparity is between playing the NBA and not playing in the NBA. I wish I had that experience. All right, let's dive into our... Oh, no. The other thing I was going to ask you, I feel like this is good to ask before we dive into our mom. Where did your love of boxing come from then? It must be from your father, right?
Yeah, from my dad, basically. He had been not a hardcore boxing fan, but he, you know, the kind of fan who would watch, you know, got the funny box and watched it, you know, on TV anytime he could tune it in. And so we saw a lot of those Tuesday night, like USA fights, and then, and then all the HBO main events. Like that was sort of a weekend thing when they had fights, and, you know, he would get home from tending bar in the days on Saturdays and take a load off. And we'd sort of sit around and watch the fights.
Same with me, my dad, that my father, as an immigrant, wasn't like a fan of like baseball or football. He was a fan of basketball because, again, he's from the Philippines, and then a big giant fan of boxing. And so boxing, was like a deep connection between the two of us for a while. I'm sure there were Filipino athletes before Manny Pacquiao. I didn't really know them, or I certainly didn't follow them when Manny came around. And by the by, fuck Manny's politics. I just want to say that out loud. But when he came around, as a kid who grew up in an almost entirely white neighborhood, only saw really Filipino people at the Christmas party. Seeing Manny and getting to enjoy his career, starting at the Oscar fight, was, and I mean, this is, I don't know, it's, I guess it's kind of embarrassing to say, but it is 100% true, really connected me to my roots. That was like a big domino to fall in my life, is to watch him and to have intense, insane pride in him as an athlete. Fuck him as a politician. I really, watching those 24 sevens on the De La Hoya fight and seeing all his buddies and hanging on and singing karaoke and eating the food. My God, I was like, these dudes are like my uncles. It was just so foundational, and it made me realize how much I missed out on. So for the De La Hoya fight, do you know Crystals in,
Queens? In Queens?
Yes.
I saw the Cotto fight there.
I wonder if I would. Oh, no. Yep. Let me tell you a story. Yeah. So I went and saw the De La Hoya fight at Crystals, and it was really a giant moment in my life where I was like, this is who I am. And like, I keep this like part of my life. That's part of my life was never, I didn't have it for a while because it's just my father for the most part where we grew up. It was the only other Filipino dude that I knew, my brothers and sisters. But watching that fight at Crystals was like, oh my God, these are like my people. This is like part of who I am. And I just really loved it. And so like my love for boxing and my love for Manny and specific Fuck His Politics really tied deeply to the experience of watching that guy, this dude, you know, this Filipino rise up and just run through all these dudes and what, eight belts. I mean, just, it's such an intense, insane pride in him. I wish he wasn't a fucking politician. I wish I could just act like I didn't know shit about his fucking personal life or his personal feelings, but whatever. The only reason I wasn't at Crystals for the Cotto fight is because I got married that night.
I got married. That's a tough one to get out of.
And after the fight, how great is this? My wife, we went to a bar. I mean, we did like the whatchamacallit, the reception and stuff. And then after that, we all went to a bar for like the after thing. And then she let me watch the fight there, which was very kind of her.
That's big. Yeah. I mean that was also a moment for him where, I mean, it was just that run where each one of those fights you were thinking, and everyone was saying, he might've bit off more than he can chew on this one. And he would go out there and just beat the ever living shit out of somebody, some great other all time great Hall of Fame fighter. And it's like, what is happening with this man? And yes, in his political career is really, really hard to deal with, but what, you know, that's it, even to the end of it, you know, I mean, he's semi-retired now. I don't know, he fought like a Korean YouTuber at the end of last year. I think he probably will find some ways to milk some more money out of the sport.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But he, even when he has a meaningful fight, still, even with everything we know and all the ways he's kind of been disappointing to a lot of fans, it's hard not to get caught up in the moment when he's in there.
All right, let's dive into our moment. This moment, this Bo Galata first fight and what happens after, an amazing sports moment. To decide whether this thing goes into the first ballot Hall of Fame, we have to go through our first ballot Hall of Fame credentials. Those are the categories by which we judge our moment. The first one, analytics. These are the stats. These are the numbers. I'm going to go through some. I'm going to ask you some questions, Rafe. This will be fun. Galata, first stat, Galata, 12-1 underdog, 28-0 coming into the fight. Bo is 38-1. He's only lost to Evander Holyfield. Lou Duva, I saw this quote and I just was like, I got to include this. Lou Duva said he believed he had the best heavyweight in the world if the fights were fought in the streets and not the ring, which I love. I love the idea that this dude is the best fighter if we were fighting anywhere but a boxing ring. That's fantastic. I love that idea. I wanted to include it here. The punch stats, as compiled by CompuBox, on this night, Galata connects on 243 of 440 shots, 55%, very high. And to Bo's 143 out of 361, closer to 39.5% for Riddick Bo. Your thoughts on the fight, again, presuming there's no DQ, remove all of the low blows and the spectacular disqualification at the end of this fight. How do you think the fight is going up and without those subtractions?
Right, up until that seventh round. That's sort of that's part of the story on what makes the moment at least a contender for the for the Hall of Fame here, because it is such, like you said, Galata comes in a 12-1 underdog. That was a time in 1996 when Riddick Bowe, coming off of like the, winning the trilogy match against Evander Holyfield, he's considered the American who can beat Lennox Lewis, who has, you know, who has the belts at the time. And it's like, so Galata comes in and is just whooping his ass. Like
killing him.
Teeing off at times. Like you said, 55% connect rate on a lot of power punches in the heavyweight division. You don't really see that in boxing, because most heavy, like if you're getting hit that much by another, you know, trained fighter who is over well over 200 pounds, you're usually getting knocked out. So it's just, I mean, he is really, it looks like a huge upset about to happen. And that's sort of the first level of, wow, this is a moment. This is exciting. Yes. This guy's going to pull it off.
Yes. It was all set up to be a great underdog victory. He was really ripping shots. Like, I feel like part of the frustration that built and obviously boiled over had to have stemmed from the fact that Galata couldn't believe that he hadn't got taken Bowe out of that fight. No?
I think that's definitely, I would imagine, because he was landing his very best stuff on Bowe clean. Not, you know, Bowe was not like rolling these punches. He was just walking into a lot of them.
Yes.
Really, really nice, scary looking combinations. And at the end, he stumbled a couple of times, got knocked back, looked like he was feeling them. Something worse should have happened by then. And that panic may have started to set in for Galata.
I am not a boxing expert by any stretch of the imagination, but I think it's very cool to be a boxing expert. Like, I look at Max Kellerman talk about boxing and I go, it would be so cool if I could just say stuff about boxing and everybody believed me and like thought that I was like some expert. I wish I was like that. I'm not. That's something to, you know, take everything I say with a grain of salt. Another thing I wanted to reference before I dive back into the stats, the nicknames. I love boxing nicknames. Boxing nicknames, huge part of the sport. You can't beat it. Everybody's got a nickname. Riddick Big Daddy Bowe, fantastic. It sounds great. It rolls off the tongue. Against, do you know Andrew Galata's nickname?
I forget at this point.
It's the powerful, I mean, I didn't know. I just looked this up. The powerful pole.
Oh, man.
Which, I mean, got a very horny sort of context. Right. And I know the Polly's Polish. So I don't want to, you know, get into like a thing, but you know, the powerful pull. Anyways, it's something to consider. All right, back into the stats. Even despite the deductions from the ref, and there were point deductions in the fourth, sixth, and seventh rounds, Galata still led 67-65 on two of the official scorecards and 67-66 on the other. That is a wrinkle that I go, oh, that's a real shame that the fight didn't continue, because it would have been great to see, could he actually win a fight with all of these point deductions? That would have made for an interesting sort of final wrinkle in this fight.
Yeah, no, those scores don't sound too crazy,
right,
given the number of deductions. If there hadn't been any, and you heard that it was that close, or that Bowe was up, would think, oh man, this totally. The powerful pole was getting jobbed. but he was given a fight away with all those deductions. You can't, you know, the weird 10-9 scoring in boxing means every time, because he was winning those rounds where he was getting deducted, you know, point deductions and teeing off on Bowe's nuts, basically. And those were, yeah, so those end up, he ends up gaining nothing from those rounds, even though he was winning them.
You bring up a good point. I want us to both agree upon, I want us both to have an agreed upon term that we use for the rest of the episode. I submit that you should use nuts, and I'm going to say private parts. So when we get to talking about the low blows, I will say private parts. You will say nuts.
Right, I'm in.
By my count, and again, I'm no boxing expert, but from my untrained eye, six or seven, what I feel like could have been considered legit low blows from Galata. Six or seven. Your thoughts on that?
That sounds about right. I believe the first really flagrant one that I noticed came in the second round.
Yes.
Like pretty early. And and those he Galata, like there are like the borderline low blows where that, you know, it's you get the feeling that the boxer is trying to land a body shot or around the belt line, which is legal, and just strays a bit or or doesn't go, you know, doesn't really go for the gold or, you know, the nuts. And that was not the case with Andrew Galata. Whether it was frustration or aim or what the Big Daddy emblazoned across across Riddick Bowe's crotch. He could, it was like this magnetic pull. He could not keep his gloves away from him. I mean, he was going straight to the middle, like, you know, right. I mean, it was there. They are right bullseye low blow shots.
Yeah, totally. You bring up a good point. He's all over the waistband. Galata is. He's all over the belt line in the first round. Like he is really pinging shots right off of Bo's abdomen. They're not low, but it's right on the belt line. And it did as I was watching it. Bo is in gigantic white shorts. They're so big that it kind of makes you go like they're so big that if they were any bigger and a human was wearing them, you'd be like, hey, what's up with your shorts? Like they are big shorts and they're pulled high up on his belly. I appreciate it. I like a good con. I like a good game. I like it when boxers are like, you can't hit me below the belt. I'm going to pull them up. I'm going to make my shorts extra big. I like that. I think all that gamesmanship, I'm into it. Cork and bats, all that shit. Give me more of it. I love it. I love trying to see what you can get away with. I love that stuff. So as I look at his gigantic, like a parachute white shorts, the one thing that did stick out to me as I'm watching that first round, I would have my waistband be a different color so that you can see a line of demarcation because he's really pinging those shots in the first round right off his belt. I wonder if part of that frustrated Bo, because Bo actually gets the first warning in the second round. He throws a rabbit punch and gets the first warning of the fight from the ref. Please.
I mean, that is a dangerous punch. It's worth warning for, right? I mean, hitting guys in the back of the head is generally, you know, it's the refs are definitely watching out for that because of just the amount of damage it can do. It's a more dangerous violation than the low blows. And at that point in time, all of Galata's body work has been borderline, like you said. But you're right. Yeah. He's sort of bent over and he's throwing like two punch combinations that land right there around the belt. And it seems like that first really, really flagrant low blow that Galata hits Bo with in that second round might be in retaliation for the rabbit punch. And he's like, all right, you know, we're, you know, like Lou says, we're taking this out of the ring and into the street.
That's right. That touches back on the point I brought up earlier. I love that after the fight, Galata's corner people immediately launched into the like, wow, who started it first? Like both are like, I love anytime you're like I got to cut this thing off at the pass. Both threw that punch. Don't forget both threw that rabbit punch early. Like I love trying to see what you can get away with. Can I explain away these 6 to 7 savage shots at another man's private parts by saying he threw the first illegal? Like, listen, who's to say who threw the first illegal punch? I love that. Like sort of trying to dance your way out of a situation.
That I mean, it's really one of the most you think following boxing that you will never be surprised or galled by something that a boxing promoter or trainer will say, like whatever insane lie they come up with to justify whatever decision or thing that has happened. But then they always surprise you. There's one like that where you're like, seriously, you're really going to try and say that it's not this guy's fault that the person we just watched get warned about 8 times and just keep punching the nuts? That guy? The guy who started the riot.
I don't know what that says about me, but I love like just seeing a dude be like, I'm gonna try and get away with this. I'm gonna try and punch this guy straight in his private parts, and then I'm gonna see if we can build a case to like get me out of this mess. That's like fun to me. I don't know why, but I really appreciate them trying. I want to ask a question to you. Have you ever boxed? Have you ever been a boxer? You ever fight somebody?
No, I have not trained for real boxing.
Me either. With that said, The big reason why I've never been, I love boxing. The big reason why I've never boxed anyone is because I don't want to get hit in the face. I don't want to get hit anywhere, quite frankly. I don't want to be punched. I've been punched. Wasn't fun. I don't want to be punched anymore. I certainly don't want to be punched as like an exercise. So I've never been a boxer. That said, if I got past the point where I don't care about being punched because I want to punch because I love this sport, because I think I can make money at this sport. If the difference between me being a champion or and me making lots and lots of money is maybe throwing a low blow here and there, I'd have no problem throwing a low blow. Your thoughts on that?
I mean, that absolutely. You see, I mean, you see fighters make that decision all the time when they start to fall behind a little bit. They need, they're trying to change the momentum of a fight. It's not a legal way, but you can get, you can, if you haven't been punching a guy in the nuts for the previous five rounds, you can get away with one and that'll give you a break. It'll give you, you know, it might stay with the guy. Unfortunately, that pain might stay with the opponent for the rest of the fight. It can change the course of a fight. The crazy thing about what was happening with Golota in this one was he's winning. He's fighting great. Anytime that he's not punching Big Daddy's nuts, he is really, really making a statement. I mean, like beating him badly, beating him to the punch, landing really, really clean combinations. So it's not the kind, a lot of the time you will see fighters when they start punching low, it's because they're frustrated or sometimes a lot of the, just those kind of disqualifications, the, after the fight, the media and trainers will say, well, he was looking for a way out. He didn't want to quit.
Right.
So this was his way of quitting.
Right.
He DQ'd himself through the low blows. Why would Golota do that? He was about to have the greatest night of his life.
Totally. That's fascinating. That's a really interesting part here. And I scoured looking for a bite from Golota where he explains this. And I deeply appreciate this. It's all his people being like, well, listen, he's the guy that threw the things first. Like, I wanted to hear his reason for why he threw those low blows, but it was all just like defer. Like, I didn't do it. Did I even do that? That guy threw him first. So I appreciate that. That was great. I would throw a low blow. I would take steroids. I wouldn't blink. I'd do it all. I don't care. I wish one of the two of us had ever fought in a prize fight and been punched in the nuts so that one of the two of us could speak to how debilitating that would be. Because I am curious, like, how much was his sterling performance? Again, he walked right through Bo, who is a giant dude, by the way. How much of his sterling performance is tied to the fact that he was, again, just punching him in the private parts multiple times? Like, how much did that swing that fight? I'd love to know that answer. It's one of those great unknown, unanswered questions in life.
We can never be those balls or those nuts, and we can never be Riddick Bowe in those moments and know how much pain he was really going through. And unfortunately, we don't have that. Unfortunately, we don't have the experience of suiting up in the ring and putting on a jock strap and seeing just how bad it hurts when someone nails you right on those balls. Maybe it's never too late. We could still
never try. Too late. Listen, if Jollibee wants to sponsor me getting punched in the balls, I'll do it. I'll go do it. I'll do it for money. I need money. This is not a stat. I didn't know where to put this, so I just threw it in here because I wanted to make sure I mentioned it. And so I threw it in here early. Andrew Golota was facing 5 years in a Polish jail, and he fled the country to avoid jail time. Did you know that story?
I'm not off the top of my head.
Golota left. He was supposed to go to jail in Poland, and he left. Like, him coming to the United States and becoming a boxer is because he was fleeing a Polish jail. What happened? Let me read the quote from the article. I found this. After a scene, this is, I think, from Sports Illustrated. After a scene that can only be described as something out of Looney Tunes, Bialystoki, who is the guy that Golota apparently got into a fight with, Bialystoki found himself wearing only a shiner, his BVDs, which are underpants, and one shoe. Golota, accompanied by several boxing buddies, had removed Bialystoki's wardrobe and deposited the garments outside in the trash. Quote, I didn't want to hurt the guy. I just wanted to make him look silly. That's what Galata said about this dude. He was charged with assault and robbery, I guess because he took the guy's clothes and threw him in the trash can.
Well, I mean, that shiner didn't come from nowhere. But I mean, yeah, I look, if I'm Andrew Galata's defense lawyer, if I, you know, telling Jim Lampley after this one, I'm saying, look, who started this, by the way, all right? We don't know. It may not be his fault. And by the way, look at all the restraint that he showed in only confiscating all of his clothes and one shoe and leaving him with a black eye to freeze in the street. I mean, he could have hit him in the nuts 8 or 10 more times before all that.
So much fun. I like thinking about somebody like Galata just walking around constantly with a lawyer who can just distract everyone from all these horrific things he's done. Back to the stats: 22 injured in the melee that happened after the fight. 16 arrests were made. Those numbers sound like early COVID numbers, like way off early COVID numbers. Like, how could that possibly only be 22 injured and 16 arrests? It's absolutely insane. 150 police officers were needed to restore order. The Garden spokesperson said that the arena had 70 security men and 50 ushers there, and they needed 150 police officers to settle everything down. That's fascinating. 6 days after the bout, three Brooklyn men filed a $4.5 million lawsuit against the Garden. Rock Newman, Riddick Bowe's manager, socked with a $250,000 fine and a 1-year suspension from the sport. Those were all the stats. Anything stand out to you?
I think what you mentioned about the number of Garden security on hand, and then the additional number of police needed after the Garden security somehow let all this go through. I mean, you've probably attended some events and covered some events at Madison Square Garden. You can see these guys ahead of time, like wearing the burgundy jackets, yep. Probably middle-aged, not in great shape.
That's right.
And will give you the hardest time getting into the door, getting into the Garden. Apparently, this is not no surprise, but apparently, after that point, their job is done. They're walking home. They're going home after that. They're not getting into the middle of a Riddick Bowe riot. You know, when Brownsville comes to fight the rest of Madison Square Garden on any given night, you do not count on those security guys.
That is a you guy problem. That is a you problem, not a me problem. Yeah, 100%. It's like, wait a minute, all the people that bought tickets came in the door. My job's done. I'm out of here. It is really it's. That fight is nuts. Let's move on to the eye test. That's what did you see in this footage? I rewatched the fight. Frafe, what did you see in the footage of this fight? Either the boxing match or the melee, the riot that happens afterwards. What did you see that makes this moment extra special and make it in the first Bell Hall of Fame?
It's the melee at the end. Yes, the fight itself is crazy. The low blows are bizarre. I mean, it's already like one of these bizarre, funny boxing disasters before the melee in the ring. But the amount, all of a sudden, when I think it starts with maybe someone in Bowe's corner, you know, runs across the ring and starts just pounding, like going after Galata. And then the entire, it looks like the Royal Rumble on yeah. steroids in there, the amount of people in the ring, the commentary is just incredible. You hear in the early moments where you hear, Jim Lampley and Larry Merchant on the HBO call being sort of like manhandled a little bit. And then big George Foreman's voice comes in and he's like, don't do it, son. Don't do it. Just sit down. And then afterwards, Lampley is like, more than anything else, I want to thank George Foreman for saving my life. I don't know if you can induct something into a Hall of Fame on personal levels, but this is in my Hall of Fame. Because I remember my father and I are sick. I think when this happened, of course, we like jumped up. And then as it develops, just start laughing at everything. The really pretty awful moment where they're holding the man by his head.
Yes, full restraint, like police restraint. They've got some dude. He looks like he's up in the air, and they're holding him by the head, and he looks very uncomfortable.
Oh man! But like every moment of terrible dark humor, the people getting just like, you know, like, oh, there's another fight there, and then when when poor Lou Dufa, Galata's trainer, goes down in the ring, and they're like, we don't know if it's his heart or if he was attacked or whatever. And then later on, they start talking about Lou Dufa again, and immediately, and you know about television production better than me, but whoever at HBO had the camera ready on Lou for him to
perfect.
Come back,
yes.
And they're carrying him out through the garden on a gurney, and they can't get through the regular tunnel, so they try and climb out, and then it looks like he's going to fall off on the stairs.
100%.
It's just like, oh no! We are sick, but I remember this being one of the funniest moments of my life up until that point. I'm like 14 years old watching this with my father, and we're just like sobbing, holding each other, laughing at everything. So we still, like, I can still walk in, I can see him and be like, Lou Dufa is down, and he'll be like, oh no, Lou's down. It's the melee. The melee is what pushes it over the top.
That was so much fun listening to you. And by the way, I love the idea that I think a personal story and moment can put a moment in our first Bell Hall of Fame. I think there's no rules here. And someone having a deep personal connection to this, I love the fact that you can share that with your dad, that you can just go, Lou Dufa's down, and you guys just break into hysterics. It means you are, to be clear, it means you are both tremendous assholes, but it is very funny that you guys enjoy this.
He turned out okay. That was what mattered.
Oh my God, it's so funny. And you are absolutely right. That Lou Dufa scene, they are taking him up on the stretcher, and they're like, oh, let's take him up this little set of stairs. And so they start walking him up the stairs, but he's on a fucking gurney, and they can't fit the gurney. Like, they're like, it's like, how do we pivot to like turn the corner? And they start like lifting. All right, you lift here and like swing him around. And Lou Dufa, who's fat, I'm sorry, he's a very heavy, out of shape man. He looks like an old like 1980s like America's Funniest Home Video. It looks like the body's about to slide off the gurney. It's very funny.
I'm sorry, yo. It's so good.
It's so good.
Okay, even worse judgment perhaps on my part. Years later, as an adult, because I did get to work covering boxing a lot for Grantland and then later for The Athletic, and I met Lou Dufa's granddaughter, who was working for her mom, who inherited the promotion company Main Events, and... right after I couldn't hold it in, about 5 minutes after I met her, I was like, you know, my favorite boxing memory is when your grandfather was passed out on the ring in Madison Square Garden. My father and I laugh about that all the time. And she was a very good sport. She was like, yeah, we joke about it too. You know, she was extremely cool about it. She would have been well within her rights to be way more offended and be like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
That's so funny. The riot is so crazy that it kind of goes beyond the eye test. There's so much that goes on, and it's almost like a Where's Waldo picture. Like they kept going up to those aerial shots from the roof, and you'd see all this movement. It looked like sort of like almost like molecular movement. Like there's just general movement going on. And then all of a sudden you'd see an arm swing and your eye would fly up there. And then someone would get punched in the bottom right corner. You dive down there and watch that. It's fascinating. There were a couple things I spotted. There is a guy who jumps over the top rope to punch someone. So he's like separated by a couple people. He jumps over the rope to punch someone. I think just outside the ring, maybe on the apron, just outside the ring. He's wearing big baggy jean shorts and Timberlands. So I'm guessing he's from New York. He throws a wild punch. Like, to see a dude jump over a rope to punch someone, a lot of fun. The other thing is there's a trainer one of Galata's trainers is one of the dudes just getting absolutely wailed on. Like, he is, dudes are taking turns, and like the people that are around to try and protect him are like vacillating between, oh, I'm going to stop this guy from punching him. And then as he turns that way, then the guys on the other side just start wailing on him. And then the guy turns and goes, don't punch him over on this side. And then the dudes that were punching him the first time start punching him again. That's one of, it looks to me, I'm not certain, but it looks like one of Galata's trainers or someone in his corner. And he, in a very cagey moment, separates himself from someone holding him and then crawls out of the bottom of the ring and like really scampers away. He scurries away and then like sort of vanishes, which I thought was very funny. It was very cartoonish to watch a grown man do that. And then also I was fascinated by watching all of the fighting happen and then the dudes would just disappear back into the crowd. And then you remember that they're at MSG and you could probably walk out in the front door and you're on 7th Avenue and you just disappear into the crowd of people in Manhattan. To think that there were people, again, that punched someone, that paid a ticket, watched this crazy fight, and then punched someone in the face afterwards for probably just for fun and then vanished into the night of New York City. That is a good night in New York.
There's no shortage of New Yorkers who have probably thought of their night out, their Saturday night, just like that. I'm about to go snuff someone tonight.
It was wild to look at all the fights. It looked like there were 11 separate fights by my count again. And there would be like moments where like Jim Lampley starts talking. You're like, oh, it's over. Jim Lampley's talking. They're going to fade this out. And then they'd go back to another fight, and you'd be like, oh, there's another fight. And then the cameras go back to it. Like, they didn't shy away from showing
these
things.
They keep trying to wind it down. Jim totally. Keeps trying to do yes. his outro and just be yes. like, please end this now. Get us out of here. They're like, and calmly lead us out of this thing. And then the camera just goes, and oh it's another scrum so of people. I like, you know, the guy, I talk about the Where's Waldo. I still remember the guy in like the Juwan Howard jersey.
Yeah. There's a guy in a Fila windbreaker and he's all over the arena. He's in like three separate fights in what seems like three completely different parts of the arena that night. There's a woman throwing punches. There's a dude, there's a kid, he looks like a kid. I don't know how old he is, but he looks like maybe he's like a teenager. He's just picking up chairs and throwing them on top of a pile of chairs. And he's doing it fast, like, I'm just going to fuck this whole place up. And he's just like picking up chairs and throwing them onto a pile. And then there's like an old man who's almost certainly a dad. And he yells, well, I guess I don't know what he yells because you can't hear him because he's like in the background. But he clearly does like a dad thing, like, what the fuck are you doing? And the kid like freezes and stops. It's a lot of fun to just like rewatch it multiple times and just like let your eyes float around the frame and find something new to laugh at.
Put it on mute and just repeat and see what happens.
I'll try to put as much as I can on the Instagram and the Twitter at First Ballot HOF on Instagram, at First Ballot Pod on Twitter. Mob mentality is the realest shit ever. Like you watch this thing and there's dudes throwing punches that I'm like, I don't think you're mad at anyone. I think you're just punching. Like it's wild to really watch it. There, the other two things that I wanted to mention, two other things that I spotted here in the eye test. There's a guy in like a maroon Henley. He's a white guy in like a maroon Henley and like tan shorts. Guys, like an adult man shouldn't wear shorts. That's my big thing. Yeah. I don't wear shorts. I won't wear shorts. Unless I'm giving somebody the business on the basketball court. I won't wear shorts. He's in shorts, tan shorts, and a maroon Henley. And he's just in the – it's in a wide shot. It's fantastic. And he's just, like, waving indiscriminately. Like, everybody. He's just, like, waving guy, up
yeah.
the ground.
Did oh, you see yeah, him? That guy in the ring. Yes. So do you think that he was just like, hey, mom, it's me?
Yes.
Or do
yes.
you – okay. Because that's what it looks like. But my better – the better side of me was trying to come up with some other excuse. Like, maybe he's trying to signal to someone on the broadcast team something. Maybe he's just trying to signal that he's okay, but it really looks like he's just waving. He's doing the yo, here I am.
I swear to you, you make a great point. It could be those things. I don't think it is. I think he had great seats, and I think he thought, shit, everybody's going in. I'll go in. I could get on. Someone's going to see me. I could tell somebody, did you see me on the fight? I know my buddy's watching. He wanders into the ring. He's just like kind of there. He's just floating around. He starts waving, and then it's like Larry Merchant's wrapping up in ring. He ends up behind Larry Merchant. He's like, hey, mom. He's like, it's just craziness. He's not punching anyone, but there's just like that mob mentality takes over. And all of a sudden you're standing in the middle of a ring in Madison Square Garden waving to nobody. And then there's the last thing I want to mention. There is a guy in my mind who won the post-fight fight. The most impressive thing about him, he's standing outside the ropes and he's holding with one hand, he's holding onto the rope so he doesn't fall off. And with the other hand, he's throwing punches and he's alternating. So he's sometimes he's holding the ropes with his left and punching with his right. And sometimes he's holding with the right and punching with his left. And in two shots, he knocks a dude off the apron. Really a great fighter. I don't know who he is, but he was fantastic.
I missed the alternating hands, but I do know I have that moment of the guy falling off the apron. It's very clear in my head.
It's really a blast. Let's move on. It's time for the ear test. What did we hear in this moment that might make it extra special? Lampley on the call, Larry Merchant, George Foreman, a fantastic booth there. I love Lampley. I don't know. Do boxing fans think Lampley is corny, or am I allowed to love Lampley and be fine about it?
Oh, no. Boxing fans adore Jim Lampley. Good. Great. Like, if you go to a boxing event, like anywhere, and Jim Lampley is there, you will see, like, the entire arena lining up to be like, Jim, we love you. Because he's just been there for all those moments.
Yes. And he loves it. He always gets emotional about it when he talks about his career. I find it lovely. I think it's absolutely fantastic. I love Jim Lampley. Anyways, Lampley on the call. Lots of stuff to listen to here. Here's Lampley on the call in round two on the first low blow.
A lot of going downstairs, might have been a little below the waistline. Kelly's watching upstairs to see if Bo holds and hits. Now Kelly comes back and tells Galata to keep him up.
Here's Lampley in round three low blow.
Galata with a solid low blow. Wayne Kelly stops and warns him, no point deducted so far.
He said the next time he would take a point.
Yeah, that was the second warning for low blows, so the next time would make sense.
Has Larry Merchant always just been like a little like crazy old guy?
I mean, there was a part of his life and career where he was, I think, a great sports writer in Philadelphia, but I wasn't around for that. So to me, yes, he has always just been a crazy old guy saying cranky stuff. Like, I don't know if you caught it, but you steered away from the Polish jokes, I think, wisely earlier.
Yes, yes,
Larry
yes.
Merchant doesn't do that at the end of round three. He's like, he just goes, waltzes right into it.
He really does. Here's Lampley and team in the round four low blows. I love that you can hear the ref here taking the points. Rich tapestry here.
Because he's virtually won the round with 19 seconds left in the round.
Yeah, that's the thing that it really gets lost in this moment. This massive underdog was absolutely walking through Riddick Bowe, and then all this crazy shit happened. Here's the round six low blow. Even hearing Jim Lampley's voice rise gives me like a warm, like I'm with my old man, like watching a fight, like hearing him get excited is a sound that's very tied to my childhood. I really love Jim Lampley. Here's the end of the fight. This is the last slow blow, which is absolutely savage. You can hear it. It's like he's slapping a melon. And then, the fight that starts afterwards. Everybody's saying, that's it.
The ref is, that's it. Fuck this.
In the ring that's been started by some of Bo's handlers who went after Lou Dubin. Somebody's going to get hurt in there. Somebody's going to get hurt. And there are more people trying to go in. And so
don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. They'll stop it. Don't. Get back. Go back where you'll see the talk. Get on back.
My microphone got knocked off my head.
Don't do it, son. Don't do
that. Place here. This is a very desperate situation. Lou Dubin's in trouble.
Picture him on his back right there.
74-year-old Lou Duva. 74-year-old, gotta be like 265, 270 maybe. Lou Duva flat on his back. But Lou Duva's an absolute legend. So to see this like absolute legend, this like Tommy Lasorda like body double just absolutely splayed out on his back, and there's just this maelstrom above him. It's a wild, wild
It was
scene.
Like Pedro taking out Zimmer.
Yeah, it really is. It's just wild. You mentioned earlier on George Foreman yelling, don't do that. And I love, as both as a listener on the podcast here, and then if you watch the fight, you can't see George Foreman or who he's talking to. So it creates this, like, what the fuck is going on? This, like, mystery of, like, who's he talking to? Who's he talking down, and why is he talking them down? What is it that they're about to do? I started looking for what that was, and I did find it. Let me look for it. This is a segment, a category we're going to call Scared. I don't have a better name for it, because I've not had a previous episode where I felt like one of the participants was definitely scared. But Jim Lampley, definitely scared, moves up away from the ring at a certain point to sort of avoid what's going on. He said, quote, I've seen scarier things than that that affected other people. But in terms of me being or feeling threatened in close proximity to physical violence, I would say that's the most apprehensive I've ever been. Let's listen to Jim in the moment.
In 21 years of reporting as a sports reporter and a news anchor, I've never been involved in a more personally terrifying situation than that one. This ring has been stormed by thugs and hooligans. Obviously, emotions were flowing high on both sides.
You also mentioned his thank you to George Foreman. Lampley's thank you for whatever protection he provided. Here's that.
Hey, George.
Yes.
I want to thank you for helping to keep us safe. Obviously, our viewers didn't see it, but George Foreman protected Larry Merchant and me from a lot of harm there at ringside. He kept at least two or three guys out of the ring by himself, and I pin a big medal of honor on George tonight. He did a big service for Larry and me and the rest around us at ringside, and for a lot of people who were over on our side of the ring. Thank you, George, for your forceful and honorable presence tonight.
A very sincere thank you for protecting me has got to be a vote in the favor of this moment going to the First Ballot Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I'd say, I think I'm familiar. I gather that you're probably familiar too with the sort of New York attitude of, I ain't scared of anybody.
That's
I'm from
right.
New York, right?
Yes,
100%. But seriously, who charges the ring and thinks they're going to go through George Foreman? Like, who needed to be warned by George? Hey, this is not a good idea.
Jim Lampley said, quote, most specifically, there were two white guys, probably Polish or Polish American followers of Galata, who were standing there glassy eyed. They had arrived loaded for bear and eager and ready to get into the ring. And George was just looking at them. They were probably startled enough that George Foreman was taking an interest in what they were doing. They stood still and didn't go in the ring. That's George Foreman. Maybe, I mean, who knows? Maybe one of those dudes is just like amped up on fucking drugs and he's going in there and he punches somebody that's not looking and they die. Did George Foreman save someone's life? Could you say that George Foreman saved someone's life or saved little old Larry Merchant from some sort of hospital stay? That would absolutely be additive here for this moment.
I think if you ask Jim Lampley, he would probably say, absolutely, he might have saved my life. Also, the sort of, that's still, like you say with Lampley, his ability to still sound completely straight-faced while going up there, and how is that thugs and hooligans line never
so
been
good.
Clipped for like a rap intro somewhere? Yeah, like, yeah. The ring has been filled with thugs and hooligans. Like, you know, I just hear, I can drop
good.
The thuggish, ruggish bone beat on top of that right now.
We got to do that and release it on social. That's fantastic. The next category, you mad. Rob, play my camera on clip here.
You mad.
Thank you so much. Was anyone mad? I love it when people are mad. Was anybody mad about this moment? Yes, 100%. Jason Harris, who was from the Bo camp. He is the person who really gets this riot going. They're like two dudes, Rock Hudson, Rock Newman being one of them. Another famous Rock. How did I not say Rock the rest? I go to Rock Hudson. Anyways, Rock Newman is the first, seems like the first guy that goes in the ring. Jason Harris really just amps it up and gets things going. He's the guy that runs over with what I'm pretty sure is a cell phone and starts banging it off Galata's head. Jason Harris was red hot pissed at Andrew Galata. It really just dings up his head. That was fantastic. And then I learned in researching this that Jason Harris also got in trouble for beating up the fan man in the fan man fight too. That's a loyal guy. Listen, I don't want to back with and condone what Jason Harris did, but if I know that there's a dude in my camp that is willing to fight literally anyone on my behalf, including destroying his 1996 cell phone in the process, hey, Jason Harris seems like a good friend to have.
He's loyal is the way to put it. Yeah, no, that's the thing. That this and the fan man fight are just like a couple of years separated from each other. And it's the same crew doing all of the damage, or at least getting the party started. It is, I guess it is not a coincidence at all, but it is, it's still amazing that that Bo and his team were involved in both of those crazy, crazy 90s boxing moments.
You know, I'm realizing as we're talking about it, probably almost everyone listening to this has no clue what we're talking about when we say the fan man.
That is quite possible.
Do you remember the circumstances behind the fan man? Yeah, who was he fighting?
It was in Holyfield? The middle of the second Holyfield fight. So rematch between Riddick Bowe and Evander Holyfield. Bowe won the first.
Right.
Great fight. Then I forget exactly what round it is, but in the middle of this fight, it's in Vegas. It's outside. And a guy parachutes in with a fan behind him. Like you could, they stop the fight and they say something's happening upstairs, and all of a sudden he somehow also good on that guy for landing the fan in the on the ropes. What are the chances? This is not just your run of the mill streaker. This was a full on managed to parachute into the ring during one of the biggest fights of the day, and then immediately got jumped by our man Jason Harris. Just comes in,
wrecked.
Took the entire his beeper, his cell phone, whatever he had at the time. And just smashes it on the guy's head.
It was detailed in an article I read that he hit the fan man with a walkie-talkie.
That's right. I had in my mind's eye the old Zach Morris phone, but I think walkie-talkie is correct.
Just fantastic. And he is, again, to set the picture, parachuter does land. Listen, to land in a boxing ring is super impressive. He gets on the apron, his foot is caught in the rope. Very funny. He's all tangled up in the ropes, and he's got that giant fan on his back, like a hydrofoil, like an old swamp boat. He used to propel himself. It's just, what a scene that these things both happen in Riddick Bowe fights. Just tremendous, tremendous fun. Again, I don't condone
Newman.
Go ahead.
I don't know. Rock Newman is one of these boxing managers. They feel like they really can only exist in a sport like boxing, where it's right on the line. Everything is right on the line of legal and illegal. And he reminds me of the white villain in a lot of old movies, like he's like Eddie Arcadian in The Last Dragon, the ball, or Mr. Big in Dolomite. He's the balding, sort of greasy, like really, really evil dude who is somehow in charge of a big gang of dudes.
Rock Newman is like a cross between Don King and Jimmy Hart, the mouth of the South.
Yeah, no,
Jimmy
he
Hart.
Has that true wrestling, wrestling manager energy.
He's got that bayou sort of voice and accent. He's balding on top of keeps saying. He's a real character. He, Bo Elijah Tillery fight. They were a bunch of late punches, and then I think Tillery starts kicking at Bo, and then Rock Newman jumps up and pulls Elijah Tillery over the top rope and tackles him, and Rock Newman's there punching the fan man as well. It's just a real scene. Those dudes, I don't want to condone violence. It's a bad thing, but it is very funny that these, it's like scoundrels. It's like a pack of scoundrels all doing this crazy shit every time. It's just a lot of fun. Galata takes 13 stitches in his head after the fight. Harris surrendered to police the next day, charged with second degree assault and criminal possession of a weapon, which again was a cell phone. That's a lot of fun. Anytime the police tell you that's a weapon, it's a cell phone. That's got to be a positive for the sports moment. And then another man, I found this in an article, had to mention it. Quote, another man was charged with third degree assault, a misdemeanor, was identified as Stephen Bo, but police could not confirm that he was related to the boxer. What's your name? Stephen. What's your last name, Stephen? Bo. Do you know Riddick? The cops are like, well, you know, we'll never know. We'll never know. If Stephen Bo, who was fighting on behalf of Riddick Bo and trying to punch this old Polish guy, we'll never know if they're related.
John Galata. Yeah.
Punching a John Galata. We'll just never know the true story. Fantastic. Another new segment here. Lots of new segments this episode. The sequel. What do you remember about the Galata Bo 2? What do you remember about that?
that Galata gets disqualified on low blows again. He cannot resist. That's when you realize that there's something truly wrong with him. Like this guy cannot help himself.
It's really tragic. I don't know what it is, but Galata was winning that fight as well. He headbutts him. They trade headbutts. It's like, people are there. There's lots of cuts. There's lots of blood. And then Galata just starts banging shots off his private parts and the game fights over again.
Whenever things start to go south, that's when Galata goes very far south.
I'm willing to fold in Galata Bo 2 into Galata Bo 1 as we decide this. I'm making that call. All right. Test of time. Next credential. Test of time. This is when we compare this moment against other moments like it in history. Other crazy moments. Here are my questions to you. I'm going to ask three and then you can decide which. Because listen, how many crazy like riot things are we going to put in the First Bell Hall of Fame? Maybe none. Maybe one. Let's find out. Is this crazier than the Fan Man? The Fan Man is Bo Holyfield. Bo had just beaten Holyfield. This is a title fight. And there's a guy with, again, the hydrofoil fan on his back, lands. Everybody's wailing on him. That's a crazy moment. Tyson bit Holyfield's ear. Crazy moment. Malice at the Palace. Insane moment. Is this moment crazier than any of those moments? And does that impact whether this Bo Galata fight should go into our First Bell Hall of Fame?
Look, this is a hard one to argue straight face that this one belongs in there over, especially Tyson biting Holyfield's ear. That is probably the iconic what the fuck just happened boxing moment of our lifetime, certainly, and it was in the same era. Like, if you had to pick one and you're trying to be objective, whatever the heck that means in this case, you would go with that one first. And you could say the same, I think, Malice in the Palace. If there can only be one melee, that one is way more significant in the grand scheme of American sports. It is more a part of the people's minds. People remember it better. Maybe just not only because it was more recent, but just because of what it meant to the NBA. But for me, that the extended insane riot footage that comes out of this is different and of a greater magnitude than anything you get in those other ones. The madness does not last as long in any of those other crazy fights or crazy truth. Crazy moments.
It's like a forest fire where like a spark happens here and then the fire starts raging and the firefighters run over there, put it out, and then another spark, another piece of Kindle catches a spark and then another fire starts. It really is extended. And again, it's not to say that multiples of those moments can't get in. You're right, the bite is fantastic. Did you know that in his career Galata bit a guy as well?
I think I remember that, yes. But the body stayed intact, right?
He did,
No pieces came off.
Correct. Samson Pahua, Galata bites him. Here is one of Galata's cornermen talking about that moment.
The referee comes out. Your man bit the other fighter. Andrew, did you bite the guy? Andrew looked at us and he said, I had to bite the motherfucker.
I mean, ice cold, baby. Ice cold. You got to do what you got to do. And then he bites the fighter. They take the timeout and then they get back to the fight and then Galata knocks the dude out. Can you imagine getting bit and then knocked out? I mean, god damn. That's a fucking rough night. Holy shit. And then the Malice of the Palace, the one thing I want to mention about Malice of the Palace is, and this is 100% true, I'm living with roommates and they're going out for the night and I was like, I'm going to stay home. And they're like, what are you going to do? I'm like, I'm going to watch the basketball game. And I turn on the television and the foul happens between Ben Wallace and Ron Artest. I literally turn on the television a moment before the Malice of the Palace happened. Imagine me. And then they didn't go out because I was like, what the fuck? And they're like, what happened? And everybody comes running back in, and like, well, we watched Malice of the Palace that way. That was a blast. Again, lots of those moments will likely be in the hall at some point in time. Next category, burning questions. These are questions that the answers to these questions might decide our moment's fate. My question is to you, Rafe. Does this moment, does it destroy Galata's career?
Yes. Maybe because this was the chance to rise to that championship level. Getting that win would have changed his career in a way that really he could never get back. Maybe, you know, even because by the time they fought again, Bo, it was really just it was a cash grab for both fighters.
Yeah. Yeah. You're that's very interesting, because I was sort of approaching this from the angle of the guy's career ends pretty soon after this, after the second fight. Like, he quits, he retires, he like leaves the sport. And so this was the end of his career. And I found that fascinating, that this kind of ended a guy's sporting career. But I think you're right. What's lost here is how close he was to stardom and like fame and like everything he's always wanted. As you mentioned that, I sort of thought of like Gordon Hayward playing for Butler, shooting that shot. Mm-hmm. Like, Butler was on the doorstep of winning a national title. And for that, like being there, like, who's your story forever? And imagine get Gordon Hayward, instead of taking that shot, like turns to whichever team they're playing, maybe it's the Tar Heels, and just punching a dude in the private parts. Like, that's like the corollary there.
just self-immolating in the most dramatic and inexplicable way. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Because I mean, that happens all the time in boxing, where a fighter is on the verge of a huge upset. It's going to change his life, going to be able to fight for titles and make millions of dollars after that. But when he doesn't get it, it's because it was a bad scorecard. Yeah. The ref screwed him. Right. The judges, or he just runs out of gas, and the champion sort of comes back at the end and makes enough and does enough to win. You know, there are lots of ways to lose and be disappointed like that in boxing. What you don't see is when the guy just blows up on his own by hitting his opponent in the nuts a million times.
To that end, the winner, Riddick Bowe, is the one that calls for the rematch, which I find an interesting little wrinkle here, that Bowe wins the fight and is instantly like, wait, we got to rematch this fight. That's a lot of fun. Rafe, I see that the clock is running down on us. It's almost time for America's favorite podcast segment. It's called More Important. Are you familiar with More Important, you may ask honestly, answer honestly, rather?
I can't remember.
More, perfect. Great. Listen, that doesn't hurt my feelings. No, More Important. People love it. People love More Important. Are you ready for More Important, Ray?
Yeah.
Great. Boxing, it's a fantastic sport. You've covered it. You've been paid to cover it. You've watched it for years and years. But it is two men savagely beating each other with concussions, with people's mental health these days. Shouldn't we end boxing? To be serious here for a moment, shouldn't we end boxing as a sport? These men are never the same. They're never the same. Listen to Riddick Bowe at the start of his career and listen to Riddick Bowe at the end of his career. It's terribly, terribly sad. Rafe Bartholomew, instead of getting paid to cover the sport, shouldn't we end it?
Ethically speaking?
I'm sorry. We don't have time for that. No one gives a shit about your answer to that question, Rafe. It's time for something more important. The music's playing. There's a ticker going down. It was counting us down. We got to get to more important questions. These are more important questions. Your answer to these questions will be more important than any of the bullshit you were about to say about boxing and saving people's lives. Are you ready for more important, Rafe?
I am ready.
Your answers to these questions will define who you are on this planet. Number one, here we go. First question. Music's playing. Guitars. What is your favorite beverage?
Period. Diet Coke.
Wait. Diet Coke. Oh, I don't like the diet. Boo on the diet. Boo him.
I don't feel good about it either. There's a great Bernard Hopkins, speaking of a boxer, clip of him saying, like, soda is the liquid crack.
It really is. Next question. Who's your favorite boxer of all time?
All right, I'll go with Triple G, Gennady Golovkin, just because I was able to cover almost his entire career. Yeah. I was at his first fight in the States.
Amazing.
And he was an amazing boxer to cover.
Great fighter. Great nickname, Triple G. I mean, goddamn. Also, his name's fantastic, Gennady Golovkin. Just fantastic. To that end, best boxing nickname. There is a right answer. I want you to know there is a right answer. And if you don't say it, I'm coming over the top and saying that you're wrong and telling you what the right answer is.
Big Daddy Bo is not, it can't be far off.
Yeah, it's very good. That is not the answer. I'm so sorry, Rafe. The answer is Marvelous Marvin Hagler.
I mean, on my father's favorite boxer, and one, you know, one who, if I think I were of the right age, yes, I would have been right there with him.
Yeah, what a great nickname. It's like the closest thing to like a wrestling, Marvelous Marvin Hagler. And then the guy was just an absolute pit bull. That's the best nickname. Okay, here we go. Do you have a favorite fight of all time? Do you have a fight that you love?
I would say the fourth Pacquiao Marquez fight, which is sad for a lot of fans who don't like to see Manny get knocked out cold at the end of it. But everything that happens in the preceding, you know, five rounds is just electric.
It really is. You have a favorite wrestling finishing move? I don't know that you watch wrestling or that you ever watch wrestling, but as a boxing guy, I have to believe that as a kid growing up, you watched professional wrestling. Do you have a favorite wrestling finishing move?
It's corny, but it's probably that Hulk Hogan leg drop. I mean, I was deep into Hulkamania back in the day. I can't even defend the move. It's not that fun to watch, but I wanted to see him land that big ass leg on guys.
It really was. Like that was the time when one of those dudes lands one of those moves, it's lights out, game over. You're not getting up from a finishing move in that era. That's fantastic.
I mean, the better part of the Hulk matches were after he's getting beat up for 5 minutes and then starts doing the ear motions to the crowd, and all of a sudden comes back and rips his shirt off. That was really the moment. But I got to go with his finisher too.
It's great. You get one chain restaurant. You can eat at one chain restaurant for the rest of your life. What is it?
Jollibee.
Oh, here we go. This guy's so Filipino. This guy's way more Filipino than I am. Rafe, the next credential, cosign, the floor is yours, the mic is yours. Does the Bo Holyfield fight fracas belong in the First Bout Hall of Fame, and why?
Absolutely, it belongs in the Hall of Fame. I think because it is, to my knowledge, the sports riot melee with the greatest comedic value, dark comedy value, the most extended violent footage. We're talking about wrestling. This is like ECW at its peak, only realer. And it is it's also one of the things I'll never forget, where I was when I saw it in all of those conditions. And I can still, the people who were there with me at that time, we still talk about it today.
It's time for the induction speech. That's when me, Neil, I get to decide whether this thing goes in. I'm going to take everything Rafe said into account. Listen, he's very important. He's an expert here. But this is ultimately my Hall of Fame. I have to make the decision. And I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it right now. I was all set to say no to this thing. And I'm not 100% sure what I'm going to do. I will say that you and your father sharing this and hearing that personal side, it means a lot. Maybe that's corny, but it does. I love the idea that you could just get on the phone with your old man and be like, Lou Duva's down, and you guys just having a blast. Like, my God, that's a lot of fun. And let me say something else that I've brought up, both on the Trey Kirby episode and the Dan Devine episode. Performance has results. Rafe comes in here and throws a 55% CompuBox stat number in this episode. It was fantastic. It was a blast. His performance has results. And the result might be that this moment gets into the First Bout Hall of Fame. It is a crazy moment. It's a crazy fight. It results in a crazy fight. It gives birth to another also crazy fight. There's an absolute pure riot, a true blue fracas afterwards. A 74-year-old man splayed out on the ground. I've talked about the guy changing hands and punching people off the apron. I've talked about the dude in the Tims jumping over and punching. Jim Lampley was visibly and audibly terrified. He's thanking George Foreman for maybe saving a life. Larry Merchant is all crazy and loony. Lou Duva almost falls off the gurney. I'm sorry. I got to put this thing in the First Bout Hall of Fame. It just has to go in. Congratulations, Lou Duva. Rick Bowe. Andrew Galata, all of the Polish people there that night, all of the people from Brownsville that showed up, the guy in the Tims, the dude that's waving to no one in particular, congratulations to all of you. This moment is in the First Bout Hall of Fame.
Rightly so. Rightly
so. God, what a thrill. This was so much fun. I really appreciate you doing it, Rafe. What can you plug? How can people follow you?
Oh, man, I don't know what's left to plug. I think if you have not read Pacific Rims or 2 and 2 or any of those books, that's the work that I am particularly proud of. So that's please check them out. I'm on Twitter at Rafe Boogs. I don't really care, but you know, I might as well. I do like to make jokes.
If you are Filipino or if you love basketball, Pacific Rims is a fucking banger. It's that you will always be the author of Pacific Rims. I said that to you before we started, and that's just the truth. You will always, that is who you will be in my eyes forever, and I mean that as the highest compliment. Rafe, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Neil.
That's it. That's the show. My thanks to Mr. Rafe Bartholomew. A true joy to recount that fight with you. Support him in his work. Listen to Rafe's new podcast, The Global Bounce, about the world's love affair with basketball. Soon available on, at minimum, Apple and Spotify. Credits: Jessica Singh, Robert Rucci, Rhythm J, Jorge Naranjo. Rate and review us, tell a friend, and come back next week for more Freestyle.